As an advisor, I'm always curious about what is the path that most people don't choose. It may be the most difficult and challenging, but it will get me to my goal faster than everybody else. So we are launching Elite Plus. This is the community for advisors that really want to engage. You get to hang out with me a couple times a month live, asking questions, trying to grow our practice together. You'll get for free our financial planning software that'll help you deliver a better financial planning experience to your clients. You'll have access to Q&A cohorts with other advisors, and you'll have our full library of resources. This is for you if you are ready to go all in. If you want to be challenged to grow, you need to come hang out in Elite Plus. Join the Elite Plus membership today. Visit gobeelite.com and experience the program that transforms advisors into leaders.
Welcome to this episode of the Elite Advisor Podcast. Today we're going to be talking to Riddick. He is a founder of multiple fintech companies, been through a couple exits. He has a wealth of knowledge that he's going to bring to us today. He's also going to give his insight on our industry from his perspective. He has an all-in platform now to serve financial advisors from a tech side. This is going to be a great conversation with a lot of great insights. Let's dive in. Good morning, Riddick. Thanks for being here. I'm excited to jump in with you.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited for this.
For our listeners, what I love is your entrepreneurial story. Obviously, you're connected to our space as well. But I'd love to jump in if you can give us your background. Because I think it helped tease up. I think at times people can see some of the stuff that you've done and they're like, oh, that's just for him, not for me. So I love a good origin story. So if we can jump in.
Absolutely. So the story starts in California. I grew up in California in the Bay Area and just fell in love with computers when I was about 5 or 6 years old. And I loved everything about it and just fell in love with making software as a kid and ended up just teaching myself how to program, put up websites when the internet was coming out and becoming more popular and started making money online. And really at an early age, probably around 12 or 13, I knew I found my calling, which I think is the best gift I've ever received, which is that I could make something out of nothing just using software and putting it out there and I would get paid for it. Ultimately, went to college to study computer science at University of California at Berkeley and ended up dropping out of school. This is now about almost 15 years ago. And since then started two technology companies. First one was a cloud storage company, raised money from venture capital investors, Y Combinator, a number of others, and eventually sold that to Box, the now publicly traded cloud storage enterprise software company. That was in 2014, the year right before Box went public. Important point in the story, but I'll come back to that. Really, after that, caught the entrepreneurial bug. We stayed at Box and integrated our software. So if you've ever used any of Box's desktop products, that's the same stuff we were building back in my dorm room. I'm sure much more improved at this point. And after that, I said, let's maybe invest in a few startups, but then got the bug again and started with a second company, which we had eventually sold to a fintech called Brex, now worth about $12.5 billion on the private markets. And that company eventually became a corporate banking and corporate wealth product. So we scaled that to about $10 billion or so, or maybe just shy of that in assets under management. And the idea was for the corporate customer, help them do all their banking activities, but also help them do treasury management, money market funds, so on and so forth to earn yield on their assets. And so that really caught on. And finally, take us to 2021 was when I decided to go and start Savvy Wealth, a tech-enabled platform for modern independent financial advisors to run their business. So I'll pause the story there and that gets us to closer to today.
No, that's great. Thanks for sharing. So through that, I know that was an abbreviated version, but I'm sure there were some sleepless nights and all-nighters with pizza, inventing stuff. But what was it like in the trenches when you had an idea? Was it like the clouds parted and this idea came upon you and like, this is the next company? Or were you trying new things constantly until you iterated it to like, oh, we finally figured it out?
You know, I wish it was the former. And if I could write the fictional version of the story, I think that's how I'd write it. But jokes aside, it certainly was the latter, where it was a lot of what I would call experimentation. And the best way to think about the ideation phase of any business, in my opinion, is simply just think of it like a science lab. So, you know, go back to whatever it was in middle school or high school, tinkering around the science lab for your class project. That's effectively what it was like, where we came up with a hypothesis, and that hypothesis was based in something where for me in that first company related to cloud storage, it was actually, I had a small short internship at a company called Twitter at the time. And it was a very small company, and I'd learned all these things, and a problem I'd found was related to the way that the company shared files. And I said, that's an interesting one. Why is there no solution for this? This very niche particular problem, that was the hypothesis. And we started to go and put it out into market. And that putting out to market is not, hey, let's build the entire product, get it out and do this high-flying launch. It was actually, let's go and actually just test this hypothesis by talking to 10 people that we think may have this problem. And then you get some of the feedback. You're able to modify some of the assumptions. Okay, let's go talk to another 10 people based on these modified assumptions. More people are resonating, but still not enough. Maybe there's a couple tweaks and so on and so forth. So there's this iteration process before you even build anything to triangulate on the most well-formed hypothesis. And there's two variables that I always talk about here. It's you're trying to find product and market fit. Before even building anything, you're trying to identify the right hypothesis for the product, but also identifying the right market. What is the target customer? You can't build something for everyone. And I feel that, you know, strongly that you have to be able to iterate and really test both of those sides of the equation.
How would you apply that? I think on a smaller scale, you have a lot of entrepreneurs with teams of, you know, it's just them, or there's teams of four or five, maybe up to 20. Where I've been at times in a room with a bigger part of my team, and I'm just like flowing. Here's ideas. And I've learned that, like, if the wrong people in the room and you start sharing too many ideas, they think like the company's changing. I've freaked people out before. How do you not stifle your creativity as a visionary kind of founder without, you know, scaring everyone with, you know, Rick has another idea. What are we doing next?
So I'll give the easy answer first, which is the team around you. Two factors here. Number one is, until you have a true sense of what we were just talking about, that product market fit, keep the team very, very small, because the constant churn and iteration, when you have a lot of people, just means there's more surface area, more people that you need to then make sure are okay. Mm-hmm. And the second point on that is also identify the individuals that have the ability to withstand a lot of turmoil. There's almost this identification process and talent of just the folks that embrace chaos, embrace kind of running into the fire, the experimentation phase. And there's a certain kind of individual that really likes that 0 to 1. Mm. Now, there's not that many, but so I think that's the first answer, right? It's the easy answer. Just find the people. Now, the reality is not everyone is going to have that same level of risk tolerance or excitement every time something changes. And so the next best thing after that is actually identifying and clarifying what the plan is to normalize the level of iteration and speed. So what I found actually is that the when it comes as a surprise to any team member, that's when there is a lot of existential crisis that's happening. Sure, yeah. There's the leaf of another idea. Is this really going to work? Am I, you know, should I go to a bigger company where it's a little bit more stable and so on and so forth? But if the plan laid out even prior to bringing someone on or in the early days is, hey, look, this next 12 months is going to be rapid iteration. We might switch from one to another, but here's the science and methodology in which we are applying, in which we're applying in order to identify the right thing. So you're almost normalizing the concept of iteration. And I think that helps quell it, because you're setting expectations. And so it doesn't come as a surprise. And rather, it is an expectation in order to arrive at the right answer.
Yeah, that's helpful. I look back and I think at times I saw the path in my head. And so maybe there was an assumption of like, hey, follow me, but without pausing and saying, hey, there's a system in place. I'm being intentional about this. Yeah, I think in the absence of information, the mind probably wanders to the negative in a way. And that's probably, yeah, that's something, especially with smaller teams in the past, maybe I haven't felt like this needs to be a big formal thing, but I think clarity is a gift. Yeah, and as a founder visionary, I think that I've never wanted to stifle that part. I think that's necessary, you know, to change the world. We need some people that seem a little crazy. But yeah, how are you being intentional about your impact on those around you?
It's such a great point. And I think the unspoken things in your head are the ones that others may fill in the gaps with their own version of the story. So I think just being intentional about explaining and people bringing people along for the ride, I think is actually the most important critical skill in the earliest days, yeah. Where it's less about inspiring with this, you know, very grand vision, because you're still maybe don't have that fully defined yet. It's actually being intentional about, look, I'm not being crazy. Here's what's going in my head. You can, you know, we can poke holes at this kind of more from a first principles basis of, hey, this is the process I'm thinking. Maybe you don't agree with this and we should figure out what the right way to do this is. But at least I don't want you to create any stories. Now, that's, you know, to your question on, you know, how do you actually go and do that? I think many companies find their own footing. For us and for me particularly, what I found is having a strong written communication culture is actually something that really helped, where even to this date, where the company is much larger now than it was on day one, mm-hmm. We'll still have every meeting have at least a few bullet points on context. What is the goal, the problem that we're trying to solve for that particular meeting, and so on and so forth, all the way to the, you know, here's the annual plan and why we're, you know, pursuing this strategy and not some other one, and a detailed analysis. And that could be, you know, 15 pages long that's produced and kind of left as an artifact for the year. Mm. So that written culture is the, what I found is writing equals thinking. It's this concept that I think Amazon really popularized in the last two decades with their culture. And if you're able to articulate the thoughts in a written format, then you're able to then help others come along for the ride by because they can see step by step, kind of demystify how you've arrived at the conclusions you have, rather than just trusting you blindly, which can cause these stories to appear in their head.
Yeah. Yeah, I have stuff running through my head right now where I'm like, oh, wow, that's a... There is this element of like, hey, trust me, I've proven myself. And then like this grand reveal. Yeah, that's probably not the best option. I think would you say, are you like an inspirational leader, or are you more of like lead by example? Are you coming in on team meetings, like smoke going, lights blaring, like pumping up? Or you're like, hey, you just follow me and we'll get to the finish line.
I'd say, you know, if that's a spectrum on two ends, I would say probably closer to the latter of lead by example. And really a lot of my instinctual response to a lot of things is, you know, how can I help in helping get the job across the finish line?
Yeah.
I think having some level, I think the extremes are actually helpful to understand, and actually being able to modulate between the two is the skill that I think I've learned over the last, call it 2 years. And that's usually hard. It's instinctually, I might trend towards, hey, let me help by leading by example and kind of doing, but knowing when to lean the other way and be more inspirational and zoom out is actually a critical part. Some of the best leaders I have seen, and as through osmosis learned from, is actually their ability to go from 10,000 feet inspiration to 10 feet and asking the most pointed question that is probably the most critical question, making that decision at that minute, yeah. Is probably the next level of leadership at this that I'm perfecting.
Is that kind of through repetition? What because you just find yourself in more of those situations and you're like, oh, wait, it's happening right now and I need to show up differently? Or how has that evolved?
There's two kind of intentional things that I do. One, to your point, repetition, right? It's just the rapid pace that the company grows. You just have more surface area, more time you're spending in multiple situations. So you're able to modulate and assess what the individuals in the room or in that decision or process need. So that's number one. But number two is that, you know, the having good, ability to take in and action on feedback is actually really, really important. So just as a quick exercise of reflecting on the past week, for example, of just knowing that I can tell myself, these are the areas that probably could have done a better job of either, you know, doing something a little bit differently, but also then inviting everyone else to feel comfortable giving feedback to me of, you know, in that situation, here's what could have helped. And then knowing that for the next time. So, it's actually very simple. And I think many situations in company building or any business situation can just be boiled down to, do you have good feedback mechanisms and do you have enough repetitions? And basically that's the muscle you're able to build in any sort of leadership.
Was that natural for you, the feedback part, or was that something, you know, as a young founder, you're like, I got this. Who are you to question me? Has that evolved over time?
It certainly has. It certainly has. I'd say if I reflect back on the young dropout out of college, I think, I remember myself as much more stubborn. I don't need any help and I can do everything myself. And I know better than everyone else. And, you know, I think that causes a lot more friction than helps. And then also, by the way, along the years, as the wisdom of life and maturity came to me, the thing that kept resonating in my mind was something another leader told me, which is you get no extra points for doing things yourself, so you might as well get all the help you can. Which is so true. Ultimately, you know, if you're the it's really your ego that's talking when you're saying, hey, I need to do all this myself. But ultimately, big, you know, successful businesses and missions are really only fulfilled by a strong group of people.
Yeah.
So that was that took time. That took many years to really grasp my mind around. Mm-hmm. And I think it's probably one of the most important changes that I've learned over the last decade.
Nice. What's your resistance story been like? Early on, was it, I got to make money to eat and I don't know if any of this is going to work? And then it's like, once you kind of hit some home runs and it's like, hey, is then comfort the thing you have to fight against? What's been your journey with that?
Early on, I'm thinking back to even just being a kid in middle school, because like I mentioned in the story, really, I think that was the most transformative portion of the journey of knowing that this is something that I want to do in the future. It just gave me a lot of years, right? So at the age of 12 to 18 or 19, when I was dropping out of school, I just had all those years to really train that muscle of building software. And I think the resistance story at the time, it just didn't register in my head. You know, it's the naivete of just being a little kid and just having no concept of what are the consequences of doing something like this. So I just thought, well, isn't this just the default way? You decide what you want to do and then you go and do it.
Yeah.
I think the resistance story actually came when push came to shove. I was in college, had a little bit more sensibility in my mind by this point. And it truly meant there was a clear actual cost. It was basically, I was going to leave this college degree midway. So already spent some money into this. There was effectively this opportunity cost at the time. And then leaving college, it was basically this you know, black hole of just this sinking feeling of, I have no idea what to do now. And, you know, raising money from investors was something of just, you know, the school of hard knocks is what the resistance was. I think it was 130, 140 meetings with investors where I think 12 said yes. And I call that, you know, that's an excellent outcome. Yeah. But I can say that now. But in the moment, when you're 18, 19 years old, the thing that you're actually trying to overcome is actually the games that your mind is playing. Yeah. Because everything up until then, you're just letting naivete, let the natural response, let's go do this. Exactly. And once you hear all these no's, you've, what is it, 120 plus no's, that's when you start questioning all of these things in your mind. And so I think that's the resistance where I decided that this was going to be the hardest mental game I can play at that age. And so therefore I must overcome it. Mm. Because I think this notion of only I can improve myself in the most rapid way possible was the way that I convinced myself that this is the resistance I need to overcome. And I still think today that 95% of the problems I'm facing are generally going to be some resistance I have in my head of, this seems too unbelievable or unfathomable. And I think the believing the unbelievable is like the most, the biggest gift anyone can provide.
Mm. So you've gotten to a place where you've kind of normalized the tension of that. That it probably won't ever go away, but it gets easier.
Exactly. I would say, the tension continues and it ebbs and flows. I think it's never truly gotten easier, but that's not because, but that's only because I think the difficulty changes at each step function. So for example, if you were to tell my 18-year-old version that you know, I'd have to solve the problems of what it looks like today, that'd be overwhelming. And actually, that probably, there, I don't know how that could have happened in a rapid fashion. And so I think it's actually this notion of you compound over the years on your learnings, and most importantly, the actual kind of no's and failures, because that's the thing that builds the, call it the muscle and around the failures. And so I think the game today is actually just much harder. So the amount of discomfort is probably the same as it was in the early days. It just, I benefit from the compounding of, you know, over a decade and just having to do this on a daily basis.
Nice. Yeah, well said. I like that. How long were you at Berkeley?
Three semesters. So what is that, year and a half?
Okay. My cousin played volleyball there, so I would go visit her when I was in college. Crazy campus. It was fun to walk around and just experience it.
100%. Yeah. Very, very unique, unique culture and campus, for sure. It was great.
Yeah. Okay. So fast forward now, you are in the fintech space. I'm curious your feedback to advisors that are kind of boots on the ground. Cause I do experience when I'm coaching thousands of advisors and I'm still an active advisor, is that there feels to be some kind of disconnect from like the big corporate level, the tools they're using, the value prop they have. And then the fact that only 20% of advisors last beyond 3 to 5 years, it's like, okay, something's not connecting if our retention rate is so low, yet the industry is still very profitable. And so I'm curious, from what you've learned working on the side of the business that you are, do you have insider advice for advisors that are not necessarily on their way out, where they're like, I'm just going to kind of ride the status quo, but they're like, well, where are we going and how do I get ready for that?
Absolutely. So I think the earliest years, the most formative years of being an advisor is really going back to that, what I would call that product market fit question. And in this case, the product just happens to be where you as an advisor are off, what services you're offering, the way that you offer those services, what are the unique value props that you have. And then the market is simply the niche that the client that you're looking to serve. And so I think that you look at the stats and the first 3 to 5 years are so formative, but have the steepest drop off because it is really hard to figure that product market fit question out when, you know, in a very kind of crowded and noisy market. This actually goes to the notion that every advisor has a really hard job in the early years. You're basically trying to start an independent business, each and every one of these advisors. Yeah. So there's a few things. One is that the infrastructure that a platform can provide, in our opinion, is certainly one of the most critical things that can help alleviate a lot of the, call it the consternation and churn in those earliest years, because that is not something that is going to directly impact that product market fit, that really working with clients and understanding what is your unique value prop. So the technology stack, the servicing, and so on and so forth. In fact, we think that we could actually, based on what we've built, is actually that can be something that is able to reduce the amount of time you spend on the middle and back office, because that's not, you know, working towards that. Second is actually that the incentive systems of most of these firms and platforms is actually that they want to bring in as many advisors as possible because they don't care if one person is not working out versus another. Ultimately, it's just, you know, they're still benefiting from it. Yeah. And I think the way we always think about it is actually, if you believe that every advisor is running an independent business, then why don't we treat every advisor with respect and call it that way from the beginning? And we say, look, the advisor at Savvy is running an independent business. We're here to support the advisor, and we have all of our success metrics based on the how much we're able to support the advisor, response rates, success, satisfaction scores, and so on and so forth. So I think those two things are the things that I would be thinking about as an advisor. How can I get rid of all of this middle and back office work as much as possible? Because it's not moving the needle on figuring out my product and fit market fit. And then how do I find a firm that's aligned with me in making it such that the firm is really treating the advisor as their customer and making sure they're satisfied so that they can focus on figuring out what works best for the client.
Yeah. I hear from a lot of advisors, unfortunately, and I felt this way in the past too, where it's like whatever the partner is, whether it's the umbrella RIA or some tech, like it's almost they're like a resistance point to success, like a necessary piece. Obviously, we're in a very compliance heavy environment. All this stuff is necessary. Those rules are always changing. What was the thesis around savvy wealth? Like, what was the thing you're saying? We see this, and that's the thing we want to solve.
When we originally were starting the company, the thesis was to effectively flip the narrative, where we said, how can we, instead of being a friction point for the advisor, enable a lot of the behaviors and actions the advisors want without obviously breaching the lines of compliance and doing something egregious. Mm-hmm. So what that meant was, every single time that we had heard an advisor tell us a story about this is what my firm or platform couldn't help me with, we always tried to go back and think, is there a solution we have? And that solution could be, is it a process change and it's just a, you know, it's a service team member on the operations team? Is it a software limitation that the other firms are bringing in? And it's actually, there's no technical reason we can't actually overcome that. So could we build that? Mm-hmm. Or is it something that no one has thought about in a creative way? Maybe it's a compliance related thing. And it's actually simply that no one has ever questioned whether the interpretation of the compliance rules and regulations can be treated differently. And I don't mean to be, you know, we're not being cute with the compliance. It's simply just, hey, let's make sure that this is exactly, you know, is actually not allowed versus this. So in each of these cases, it's trying to find a way to say yes to what the advisor wants to do, and then coming back and meeting in the middle of saying, hey, this is where the line has to be drawn based on X, Y, and Z. But it just goes back to this whole notion of treat the advisor as the customer. We just found that none of these firms were doing it that way. They were treating it more almost as an adversarial relationship across the table.
Yeah.
And then also bring them along for the journey. If you're going to say no for something, explain why, so that at least they understand. Otherwise, they're just, you know, it just builds all this mistrust between the platform and the advisor when things are becoming, you know, thrown over the line and coming back and saying no without any context.
Yeah. I remember sitting in some rooms as a young advisor frustrated because I was like, it feels like I'm paying you a portion of my business, but I'm dealing with mistakes all the time. Like most of the time we spend interacting is like fixing something that went wrong, as opposed to what if we didn't interact very much because I didn't have to, and everything that was, you guys were actually growing my business and you were able to communicate with me how you were helping me grow my business. I probably would have cared a lot less about your piece, you know, but I find a lot of advisors are frustrated about their payouts, and it's like, sure, there's probably some that'll never be happy. You know, they just want to, you know, get as much as they can, and they're less concerned about the other company making money. But I'm like, I think most are like, I need you to help me understand why I'm paying $200,000, whatever portion of my business, for this piece, when what I do know is I could go out and probably build it on my own cheaper. That doesn't mean I want to. How are you guys approaching like reminding the advisors and communicating like this is a value add, not just like a necessary compliance tech tool?
Yeah, it's a few ways. There's no one silver bullet. One is constant communication at all different altitudes, really, where we'll do, for example, we'll do monthly town halls with everyone and explain, hey, here are all the updates from the last month. Here's what's going to happen, you know, going forward. So everyone's apprised of, well, what's in the pipe. Then whenever we're releasing any new software feature, or even the, you know, an ops, new kind of ops hire or whatever it is, being very clear and kind of explaining and showcasing that to advisors. And then oftentimes it's case studies of, hey, here's how other advisors are leveraging X, Y, and Z tool to then, so that they can get an idea of, well, this is an interesting way to, that I can use this. All to say, we've actually now found that this is even more important, given that, you know, we've grown both the products and services we offer, but also the base of advisors that are leveraging it. We actually have a dedicated team called the Advisor Success Team. Mm. And that Advisor Success Team, is their sole job is to make sure that their advisors that they partner with, that they're supporting, understand the tools and services accessible to them, right? What is the menu of options? And that can be overwhelming sometimes. And then based on that, helping them with their business, almost acting like a business consultant of, hey, potentially these tools can help you in X, Y, and Z way. It's never overbearing. No one's ever forced to use it, but just offering those suggestions makes it really easy on the advisor so that they don't have to sit down and start to study a completely new system and try to apply all this logic that they, again, just not frankly a good use of their time.
Yeah. What's the feedback loop you guys create? I guess that team probably gets feedback. Do you have like an advisory board of advisors? Like, how do you stay as in touch as possible with like what's happening day to day for an advisor?
Yeah, it's something that's top of mind for us since day one. Strong feedback culture. Basically, we say, again, multiple altitudes. We do have now what we call the advisory council. So it's a select few advisors, rotates periodically, and that's a very targeted way to get a very structured meeting of getting good feedback. So it's the executive staff plus that select few advisors. We also have the advisor success team, of course, constantly engaging, and a number of other teams. So you're collecting feedback that way. And our product development, our software development team is also sitting with the advisors constantly and getting their feedback. And oftentimes they'll show very early wireframes and start to get feedback all the way to other, other modalities. So those are all the structured ways. And then we use internal company comms, Slack, and in the product. Advisors are constantly submitting new functionality and feedback. So we're always triaging that and using that to define what the roadmap looks like going forward.
Nice. All right, as we wrap up, for everybody listening that is not familiar with Savvy Wealth yet, give us kind of like were we the only solution you need? Or it's like, hey, this is the piece of the stack that we dominate. How would you break that down for us?
We at Savvy Wealth, we're an all-in-one AI-enabled platform. So truly, it is the one solution that any advisor needs. We help from everything on the advisor's onboarding, licenses, compliance, and so on and so forth, to building all the software and services for your CRM, the inter-end financial planning, all the note-taking. We have a client servicing team, investment operations support, client marketing. So it's really a 360 on anything that happens in the middle and back office, everything except the client and the advisor relationship, because that's the area that obviously the advisor wants to really focus on. We're here to help and support across the board.
Love that. Yeah, as I speak and coach, I think the some of the epiphanies I've had is there's the activities of our work and then there's the purpose of our work. And I think at times, especially with AI coming, if you think the activities of your work are your purpose, like you probably should be scared, if the rebalancing of portfolio, the placement of life insurance, like running the quote, like if those are the things that you think you are in this industry to do, like a lot of that probably will be streamlined, eliminated. But if your purpose is to educate, inspire, encourage, challenge people to take action on their plan and guide them through that process, I mean, we're not going anywhere. I do think, though, that your skill set has to be things like communication, your knowledge has to be there on the spot. Like, how are you illustrating your value to people? And I feel like I wish on day one, somebody would have told me like, hey, it's not about learning to sell life insurance. Like, you got to do that. But like, really, here's the skills you need to learn. Because from trial and error, I had to be like, oh, actually, I probably have to be a great communicator. Like, that actually might be the main skill I need to learn. And it took me a long time to figure that out.
It's spot on and very well said. I always am reminded that when we're talking about the altitudes, operating at 10,000 feet versus 10 feet, oftentimes advisors are not talking at the 10 feet level with clients and talking about the nitty gritty details of the specific investment or the insurance policy because they're already trusted on that realm. So it's really about finding the right balance and that communication to the client of explaining and kind of bringing them along for the ride at the right altitude is the most important piece to the puzzle.
Good word. All right, my friend, I appreciate you. Thanks for being here.
Likewise. Thank you. Really appreciate it.